I don't normally do this, but because this video is so well put together, we're going to spend the next hour watching a documentary. The documentary is called White Like Me, and it's put together by a white person, which to me I think is significant in that a lot of times we hear about white privilege or sort of what does it mean to be white in America, and it's often from the perspective of a person of color, and it could be sort of more of a rant, or it could be one that's sort of to induce white guilt, which there's validity to that, but I think for me as a white person, to hear another white male break it down is extremely helpful. And the main reason for showing this video is we're typically blind to what it means to be white in America and the advantages. And 2 days ago we did the exercise where we got to experience some of the dynamics. What this documentary does is takes a lot of the stuff that we've been reading up until this point in the textbook of different racial and ethnic minorities and the white ethnicity, and it summarizes a lot of those dynamics. So a lot of things that are in this documentary will be stuff that's covered on the first exam, a lot of the concepts. It's just a good sort of summary overview, and so I feel it's really worth it. Look at it in an extended version. So Tim Wise is the person who put together the documentary, and he's an author, an activist, racial equity activist, and he does a great job of putting it together. So we're going to watch this movie. It'll last an hour, and then at the end, I'm going to give you a review guide for the exam. So the exam is next Thursday, but basically for the exam, there's going to be 25 terms that I want you to know and concepts, and I'm going to ask you to define or explain the concept and give a real-world example. It'll be a pretty straightforward exam and the review guide. If you know all the terms on the review guide, you'll do well on the exam. And so a lot of the stuff will be covered in this video as well.
When it comes to race, we've overcome quite a lot in this country. Slavery. Civil War. Segregation. We've even elected a black man to the highest office in the land.
Change has come to America.
But as tempting as it might be to celebrate these things as signs that we've entered into a period of colorblind, post-racial harmony,
we have to admit that we're moving forward in this world and that race issues are moving to the periphery.
I think those problems are largely behind us.
The fact is, racial inequality still exists.
Today, there are more African Americans in prison or jail on probation or parole than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began.
And racial bias still affects the way we view others.
I want you to check out this protester. See the sign he's waving there? It's the president made to look like an African witch doctor.
And when we fail to recognize that, we not only continue to do an injustice to people of color, we end up doing damage to white folks as well. I'm Tim Wise, an anti-racist educator and author. I grew up in the South in Nashville, Tennessee, and at a very early age, I figured out that race mattered. My parents were educated in a completely segregated environment, and wanting me to have a different experience than they had had, they decided to send me to a preschool program at Tennessee State University, a historically black college. In a class of about 20 kids, I was one of only 3 students who weren't black. The teachers, the staff, the administrators there were also mostly African American. And this meant that from a very young age, I learned to respect black authority figures in a way that many of my white peers probably wouldn't have. And this seemingly minor detail made a huge difference in how I came to see the world. It meant that most of my early friends were black. As a result, once we started elementary school and I began to notice how those black friends were treated differently by the teachers, it affected me. And even though I didn't really have a word for what was happening then, that racial division is something I remember even years later. For college, I attended Tulane University in New Orleans. It was the late 80s, and I got heavily involved on my campus, along with other students, trying to encourage Tulane to stop investing in companies that did business with the racist government of apartheid South Africa.
These university students want their school to get rid of its investments in stocks of companies that do business in South Africa, to divest. It's become a rallying cry on campuses all across the country.
We spoke out. We set up shanty towns on the college quad and in front of the administration building in solidarity with the anti-apartheid movement. But even then, as I was becoming radicalized to struggles for equality and justice, I was largely blind to the privileges I was receiving in my own town.
The situation lately has become more complicated in the wake of the killing of a policeman and the death of his accused killer.
Around this same time, just across town in New Orleans, a black man named Adolph Archie was beaten to death in police custody.
The minute it was discovered that Adolph Archie had died, everybody knew the police had beat him to death.
I remember reading about Adolph Archie's murder in the paper, and I remember thinking how terrible it was, but I made no connection to what I was doing and the experiences I was having at Tulane. But that all changed a few weeks later. I was speaking one evening at an anti-apartheid event, and a young black female student from a neighboring college, Xavier University, asked me, in the 4 years that I'd been in New Orleans, what had I done to address racism and apartheid in that city, especially seeing as how I'd benefited from it? The feeling that came over me was like the way you feel when you see the flashing blue lights in the rearview mirror and you know you're busted. Because the truth is, I hadn't done much of anything. I had the privilege of choosing to address racism 8,000 miles away while doing nothing in the face of de facto apartheid conditions that existed right there in my own backyard. It was a powerful moment, and it made me begin to reflect on my privileges more broadly, especially my privileges as a white person.
The next United States Senator from the state of Louisiana, David Duke.
In 1990, shortly after I graduated from Tulane, David Duke, lifelong Nazi, former Klan leader, the most prominent white supremacist in the United States, was running for the United States Senate in Louisiana.
You sell things, you pass out things called nigger hunting license. A nigger hunting license.
We do not. I do not pass out. I do not.
You do not, but your lieutenants do. Maybe you do.
Says having paid the license fee is hereby licensed to hunt and kill niggers and calves during the open season in Texas. This is beautiful, David. I mean, you know, for a guy who does. It's also, I mean, it's a joke.
But it is a joke, yes. It is satire.
When I interviewed Dukes earlier this evening, he insisted that the campaign was not about his past, but about taxes, crime, and welfare reform. Nonetheless, he did acknowledge that race is an issue about which he has strong feelings.
There's racism going on in this country against white people. It's called affirmative action.
I was involved in the campaigns against him, ultimately working as the associate director of the Louisiana Coalition Against Racism and Nazism.
Appreciate it.
His message appeals to many frustrated white voters who believe the civil rights movement has gone too far.
In the end, Duke lost the election. The Nazi was defeated. But he received a stunning 60% of the white vote. The next year, he ran for governor, and he lost again, but he still received a majority of that white vote. And I remember sitting there a couple of weeks after the governor's race, realizing there was something truly frightening about the fact that 6 out of 10 people who write the same thing on their census form that I do, that they're white, were willing to vote for a Nazi. I mean, I knew they weren't Nazis, but now I also understood they were willing to vote for a guy who was.
You've got a lot of good ideas that we've been saying for a long time. It's time somebody to do it.
What it told me was that as a white person, I had very specific work that I had to do around these issues because these were my people supporting this guy. And really, for me, it was a moment when I decided to try and use what I'd learned to change that mentality in my own community.
Joining us now is Tim Wise, an educator, anti-racist advocate, and the author of White Like Me, Reflections on Race from a Privileged Son.
For more than 20 years now, I've been trying to better understand for myself and to raise awareness, among others, about the centrality of race and racism to the history of this country and how dangerous and damaging it is when white people, like me, are blind to racial inequality and our own privileges.
When you talk about white folk, you say white folk, white America, there are always some white folks in the room that think he hates white people. I get that a lot. You hate white people. I want to clear this up because I don't want to be misunderstood. I love me some white people. My wife is white. I love her. Those two little girls are white, which sometimes happens when you're both white. I love them.
When I was in high school, we read John Howard Griffin's classic book, Black Like Me. In the book, and in the movie version a couple of years later, Griffin, a white man, tells the story of how he darkened his skin with dye, medicine, and intense UV rays in order to experience what it was like for African Americans in the pre-Civil Rights South of the 1950s.
Well, what's the big idea?
I want to find out what it's like to be a Negro in the South.
You can...
Over the course of 6 weeks, Griffin recounts how he was harassed, followed, and threatened by racist whites.
You better find yourself another place to sit.
And in the end, he says that his assumption blacks were treated like second-class citizens turned out to be wrong. It was closer to 10th class.
You know what we do to troublemakers here?
No.
You kill a nigger and toss him one of these swamps, nobody ever know anything about it.
The book became a bestseller and a sensation, and it had a profound impact on me and countless other high schoolers. But when I revisited the book as an adult, something stood out that I hadn't thought about as a kid. Toward the very beginning of the book, Griffin asks, how else, except by becoming a Negro, could a white man hope to learn the truth? Ultimately concluding that the best way to find out if we had second-class citizens and what their plight was would be to become one of them.
A white Southerner has to know what it's like to be a Negro. Really know.
And you know what it's like, huh? After 10 weeks or 3 months or whatever it is, you know.
I don't know. And I can never know.
Rereading this, I realized the entire premise was off. Griffin was attempting to understand racism by momentarily occupying blackness. He became a person of color. And while there's no question there's real value in whites trying to understand and ultimately empathize with the experience of African Americans, it struck me that we rarely, if ever, turn this line of thinking around. In other words, instead of asking what it's like to be black, what if we just asked what it's like to be white?
I don't really know how, what it means really to be white or what it's supposed to mean.
I guess I never really thought about it, but it was always kind of a negative thing.
When I ask students what it means to be white, what I hear from them is a lot of confusion.
Well, the question, what does it mean to be white, it baffles my mind. I don't know what it means.
Whiteness isn't something we think much about, and in some ways, that makes perfect sense.
In terms of white culture, it's very general and very vague. Like, I think, like, sitting down and having dinner with my family. But all cultures do that.
Because when you're part of a dominant group, you're not forced to spend a lot of time thinking about how you fit in or about how your privileges as a member of the dominant group might affect others who don't belong to it.
In order to express ourselves, we don't have to fit into black culture, Hispanic culture, Asian American culture. We can just kind of do what we want. And I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just...
This doesn't mean that all white people have it easy, or that there aren't differences between the struggles of poor and working-class white kids who have to work for everything and rich white kids who have things handed to them. Of course, those differences are real. But none of that changes the fact that throughout the history of this country, being white has been far easier than not being white.
Oh, God, I love being white. I really do. Seriously, if you're not white, you're missing out, because this is thoroughly good. But let me be clear, by the way, I'm not saying that white people are better. I'm saying that being white is clearly better. Who could even argue? If it was an option, I would re-up every year. Oh, yeah, I'll take white again, absolutely. I've been enjoying that. I'm going to stick with white, thank you.
And let's face it, there's no denying that white people in the U.S. have had privileges throughout history that people of color simply haven't. Consider the very first law passed by Congress after ratifying the Constitution, the Naturalization Act of 1790, which said that free white persons and only free white persons could become full citizens of this country. Basically, our very first law as a constitutional republic gave white immigrants privileges that black people and immigrants of color and indigenous Native North Americans weren't given, all of it based purely on skin color. And whether we want to acknowledge it or not, this kind of systematic white privilege and race-based favoritism is built into the very foundations of the country.
In 1935, Franklin D. Roosevelt put his signature
on the Social Security Act.
Look at all the social programs that pulled the U.S. out of the Great Depression and helped create the middle class in this country. Programs like job insurance, which provided cash to people to give them a leg up as they looked for work.
To show how job insurance works, let's introduce Steve, a Louisiana worker who has just lost his job. He goes first to the nearest state employment office to register for a new job. Steve needn't hesitate about going in, because this office was set up just to help people like him.
But while Steve in Louisiana could apply for job insurance, not everyone else could.
Of course, he cannot collect if he belongs to any of the groups of workers that the law does not insure. These are agricultural workers, domestic service in private homes.
Agricultural workers and domestic service workers didn't qualify for assistance, and it turns out this had everything to do with race. These two jobs were overwhelmingly held by black people, and over 80% of all blacks worked in those professions. So the only way FDR could get Southern Democrats to support the Social Security Act was if he agreed to exclude those workers from benefits. This was a conscious attempt by some in Congress to exclude as many blacks as possible, and the net effect of it was to give preferential treatment to whites.
Thousands of people get a big thrill out of looking at model houses, and a much bigger thrill when they buy one.
It was the same story with crucial housing assistance for the American middle class. Loans provided by the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, allowed working class families for really the first time in American history to own their own homes.
Home ownership is the basis of a happy, contented family life. And now, through the use of a National Housing Act insured mortgage, is brought within the reach of all citizens.
But the way the bill was written, the American dream of home ownership wasn't within the reach of everyone. For the first 30 years of the program, about 98% of the recipients were white. People of color were almost completely barred. Then there was the GI Bill, which provided immense benefits to returning veterans, including low-cost mortgages, loans to start a business, cash payments for tuition, and living expenses. What the GI Bill didn't do is protect black veterans, who qualified for that assistance also, from the kinds of legal discrimination rampant in pre-civil rights America. The result was that the vast majority of those who benefited from the GI Bill were white veterans. If a program like the GI Bill ended up disproportionately benefiting people of color, you know what we'd call that? We'd call it welfare. We'd call it a reward, a handout, a gravy train.
The GI Bill of Rights is not a reward, or a handout, or a gravy train.
But that's not the way it was described.
But rather an American way to make it easier for each man to take his place once again in the community and get some of those things for which he went to war.
I'm not trying to say programs like these are bad. There's no question. They've been instrumental in creating and expanding opportunities for millions of people. The point is that we're being dishonest if we fail to explicitly acknowledge how they almost exclusively benefited white people.
Who is covered by the Social Security Act? People like these.
It needs to be understood that for hundreds of years, government assistance programs pumped literally hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars worth of wealth into the hands of white families before people of color even got to the starting gate. This is what we're talking about when we talk about white privilege, the structural advantages built into our very system that have helped white people, often without us knowing it, while making things more difficult for people of color.
For me, being white means that I'm treated as the default in a lot of cases.
Some of those privileges would be material, better job opportunities, better housing access, better educational opportunities, but some of them are psychological. Just the realization that I'm not going to be racially profiled when I'm driving around town or when I'm shopping in the mall, that I'm not going to be followed by store security because they think I might shoplift.
Before I got to college and stuff, I don't know, I was more like a punk and what have you, so there were times where I would be like shoplifting, and my race occurred to me then because I was like, man, I feel like if I was any other race or ethnicity, I would be being watched by like security. So I felt very, you know, like nothing would happen. So I didn't really mind doing it because I didn't get caught ever.
I read a paper where somebody was listing an experience where it was a group of females talking about, you know, what it's like to be a woman. And there was a white woman talking to a black woman saying, you know, well, we have similar experiences because we're both women. And the black woman looks at her and says, no, we don't. And she goes, well, yeah, but we're both women. And the black woman says, no, because when you look in the mirror, you're a woman. When I look in the mirror, I'm a black woman. So it's that thing that you have to, it's that thing that you don't notice.
For myself, from the very beginning, I was seen as a bright and capable child, and I was trapped into the higher level classes. If I didn't do well, I never had to worry that it would be ascribed to my race, that someone might say, well, of course he didn't do really very well on the SAT because, you know, he is white. And this isn't just an anecdotal one-off story. The fact is there are 20 to 25 years of research, studies which have found that students of color all around the country are worried about confirming negative stereotypes in the classroom. Any fear that somehow they might live down to a negative group stigma directly affects their performance on tests. That's something that I, as a white student, didn't have to worry about. And so we live with the legacy of inequality that began so long ago, but also the legacy of obliviousness that allows those of us in the dominant group to rarely even think about these matters. And even with all the changes and the progress we have seen, that is something that hasn't changed.
Take another break in our coverage here as we look at some of the pictures of the gathering crowd in Grant Park, Chicago, Illinois.
This crowd, as you said, Brian, they're expecting as many as 500,000 people to come out here.
Barack Obama seems on the verge of a presidency. Who could have imagined it?
On November 4th, 2008, at a little after 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, television networks began announcing the big news.
And CNN can now project that Barack Obama, 47 years old, will become the president-elect of the United States.
Almost immediately, discussion turned to the historical nature of the moment, and with good reason. For a country with such a dark history of slavery, disenfranchisement, and segregation, to elect a black man to the highest office in the land, well, it made for an emotional night.
This is a wonderful day for the world.
History in the making, first African-American president in the United States. Is this beautiful? It's very, very beautiful.
Knowing my grandparents and great-grandparents really witnessed and really went through this. So it means a lot.
African-American men and women talked proudly about how far the country had come from just a few decades before, when merely registering to vote could be a matter of life and death.
A church with a pastor's own distant cousin was shot and killed for simply trying to vote in 1930.
It sends chills up my spine.
White Americans, too, talked about the country moving forward to a better and more tolerant place.
I think it demonstrates the best of America. I had a son born 8 weeks ago, and I think he's in a better world now.
Reverend Jackson, thank you very much.
Legendary civil rights leaders like the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who served as an aide to Martin Luther King Jr. and was with him the night he was shot, wept openly as he watched Obama's victory speech on election night.
Well, I must tell you, this is unreal, it's unbelievable.
And there was a similar sense of accomplishment from Congressman John Lewis, who put his life on the line during the Freedom Rides in the 1960s to help end segregation in the South, and to this day bears scars on his head from being mercilessly beaten by angry white mobs.
The struggle, the suffering, the pain, and everything that we tried to do to create a more perfect union, it was worth it. I just don't know how to express myself tonight. I'm overwhelmed.
It's been a long time coming. But tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
Feels like America did the right thing. It feels like there's a shift in consciousness. It feels like something really big and bold has happened.
We all grew up in school classrooms with some variation of this graphic. 43 people who have occupied the office. What do they all have in common, all the faces in these ovals? 43 of them are white males. That's the barrier that's been broken tonight.
It was an exciting night, and it was easy to get swept up in the moment. Clearly, the election meant something. But what exactly did it mean?
Does anyone know what this means in terms of change of race relations in the United States, or a perception of?
Well, I'll tell you one thing it means. As a former Secretary of Education, you don't take any excuses anymore from anybody who says, the deck is stacked, I can't do anything, there's so much inbuilt this and that.
Did it mean that racism and hatred no longer posed a barrier to people of color?
And yes, it should have ended this discussion of there is a glass ceiling upon or beyond which African Americans cannot go. That's nonsense.
Did it mean that racism as we knew it had been dealt a death blow, and that a post-racial America had finally arrived?
We've achieved history tonight, and we've moved beyond something that has plagued this country from the very beginning. The whole idea of race and racial separation and unfairness.
Of course, no one would say that because Pakistan elected Benazir Bhutto as prime minister in 1988, that somehow that meant there was no more sexism in Pakistan. But that was exactly the kind of logic we got from a lot of people on election night here in America regarding race.
We have to admit that we're moving forward in this world, in this country, and that race issues, while not gone, are moving to the periphery.
These are the kind of issues that race scholar Imani Perry has been studying for years.
One of the things that happened with the election of President Obama is that he began to operate in the minds of some as an example that there were no longer barriers to racial discrimination in American society.
And those who tell us that we can't, we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can.
The argument goes, well, this person was able to excel. This person was able to beat the odds, so why in the world can't you? But really, here's one person amongst 40 million, right, who has done this extraordinary thing. What we need to do to understand whether the society is racially just is to look at what's happening amongst the 40 million and why it is that we have a belief in racial equality and yet seem to have such difficulty in moving in the direction toward it.
We still have a problem with race. And I think that until we confront it, we address it, and we work on it, we won't be anywhere near post-racial. And it's really not post-racial that we're trying to become. We're trying to become post-racist.
Of course, if you bought into this post-racial thinking, you had to ignore quite a few glaring facts. First and foremost, the actual election results. While Barack Obama won the popular vote by a solid margin, few seemed to notice that he lost the white vote in a landslide, 57 to 43. Or that in southern states like Alabama and Mississippi, he received only 10% of the white vote. Now, does that mean that every white person who voted against him did so because he was black? Of course not. But there's no question that for some white folks, that was exactly the reason. Even in northern states like Pennsylvania, it became clear that we were a long way from achieving the dream of a colorblind society.
Why are you supporting Senator McCain if you're a Democrat? Yes, sir, I do.
Let me read some of the things that we've heard at these rallies, or people have heard. They kill him. That was the first little bit of sound. Someone yelling, kill him, referring to Barack Obama in the background. Then treason has been yelled out, terrorists. And even someone's heard someone at the rally say, off with his head.
But none of this stopped the conservative pundits from blatantly ignoring this unpleasant reality.
The days of racism are over.
We have just achieved an incredible milestone.
And I take it, therefore, around the world, criticism of the United States for being a racist nation will now stop,
right?
They thought everything's fine when it comes to race in America, and that it's time to move on to other things.
We don't have racism in America anymore, so just knock it off with the charges of racism.
But in reality, the claim that we've gotten past racism and entered a post-racial society really is nothing new. In 1963, when pollsters from Gallup went door-to-door and asked white Americans if they thought whites and racial minorities were treated equally in matters of housing, education, and employment, 66% of whites said yes. In other surveys around the same time, Gallup found that nearly 90% of whites believed that black children had the same opportunities as white kids when it came to education.
Six kids were murdered in Birmingham. On a Sunday and in Sunday school, in a Christian nation, and nobody cares.
Now bear in mind, This was the height of segregation, a time when African Americans were forced to sit in the back of buses, where they were routinely refused service at restaurants and barred from voting in elections. A time when, if they dared to protest these things or step out of line, they were firehosed on the streets, beaten by police and white vigilantes, lynched and often jailed.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation.
In other words, around the same time that 200,000 people were gathering in Washington, D.C. to hear Dr. King rail against racism and injustice and demand a better future, most of us white folks were sitting at home wondering why the blacks were making such a fuss.
We're soliciting opinions on the Civil Rights Bill. Would you like to give us yours?
I'm sorry, but I don't the time right now. I think they have equal rights, and I think this is the most ridiculous thing that has ever happened. The Negroes are just as free as we are. They have the same opportunity to work. I just don't understand it. Don't approve of it. I'm gonna stand up for my rights.
Americans have a long history of wanting to believe that everything's fine when it comes to race in America, and that it's time to move on to other things. And when we hear claims that we've finally entered a post-racial, colorblind society with the election of Barack Obama, we need to remember this history. Because the fact is, racial inequalities still exist, and racial bias still affects the way that we view others. There are large and seemingly intractable gaps between whites and folks of color when it comes to income, wealth, and educational attainment, even basic health. Children born to African American women, for instance, are more than twice as likely to die within their first year than children born to white women. Even black women who don't smoke have higher rates of infant mortality for their children than white women who do smoke. You see the same trend with life expectancy. African American women will die 3 years before white women on average. African American men, 5 years before white men. Part of this has to do with access to quality health care. African Americans are twice as likely as whites to be uninsured, and when they do receive medical attention, studies have shown that they get inferior and unequal care. But even more than these factors, what the research increasingly finds is that dealing with racism and discrimination on a regular basis has incredibly damaging repercussions for black people's health. But maybe the most disturbing example of all of how race-based inequality persists in America is in our criminal justice system.
Today, there are more African Americans under correctional control, in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began.
Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, argues persuasively that America's war on drugs has resulted in a devastating new system of racial control.
Many Americans just have no idea the scale of mass incarceration in the United States because it's a phenomenon that does not affect everyone. It affects certain groups defined largely by race and class.
Breaking news out of Contra Costa County, a drug bust in
the chase. What officials say is the largest drug bust in Baltimore County.
It's not home, but minutes later, he unwittingly walks into the dragnet.
What's your name?
My name?
Yeah.
My name is Ansel.
The size of our prison system quintupled in a 30-year period of time, not due to rising crime rates, but rather because we declared a drug war, a war on drugs.
These people are wrecking our society.
If you're a casual drug user, you're an accomplice to murder.
All of us agree that the gravest domestic threat facing our nation today is drugs.
And launched a Get Tough movement that swept millions of poor people, overwhelmingly poor folks of color, into our prisons and jails, primarily for nonviolent and drug-related offenses, the very sorts of crimes that occur with roughly equal frequency in middle-class white communities and on college campuses and go largely ignored. You know, a white kid living in rural Kansas doesn't drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his ecstasy or a little bit of cocaine. He's buying it from someone most likely of his own race down the road. Drug dealing happens in all communities of all colors, but those who do time for drug crime in the United States are overwhelmingly black and brown. Once they're caught, they're swept into the criminal justice system, branded criminals and felons, and then ushered into a parallel social universe in which the basic civil and human rights that were supposedly won in the civil rights movement are stripped from them. Once branded a criminal or felon, they're denied the right to vote in many states, automatically excluded from juries, and legally discriminated against in employment, housing, access to education, and public benefits.
If you break the law, you no longer have a home and public housing.
So many of the old forms of discrimination that we supposedly left behind in the old Jim Crow era are suddenly legal again once you've been branded a felon. That's why I say we haven't ended racial caste in America. We've just redesigned it.
It might be difficult to admit, but it's certainly not difficult to understand how this kind of racialized justice system ends up benefiting white people. We're not only much less likely to be harassed by the police when we're innocent, we're also more likely to get away with illegal activity when we're guilty. Congratulating ourselves on how post-racial and colorblind we are does nothing to change these facts, and in many ways makes things worse.
I think these examples of black success help to blind us to the ways in which systems and structures operate in our society today to lock millions of people out.
And really big and bold has happened.
You know, during the Jim Crow era, examples of black success undermine the logic of the prevailing caste system. Today, you know, these black success stories actually reinforce the logic of the prevailing caste system, the superficially colorblind logic that it's their fault they're at the bottom. And if they only tried harder, they could be President Obama. And that simply isn't the case.
Going for jobs and even applying to universities, you'll hear everyone talk about like the quota. To meet their quota of, you know, their diverse population in the workplace or in the student body. So if there's, you know, a lot of white females applying for a job and they have a similar resume to one African-American female, she may get that over a white female, whether she has as much experience or not. Just because they need.
Everywhere I give talks, whether it's the Deep South, Northeast, Midwest, or the West Coast, white folks ask me, well, what about us? Why don't you talk about racism against white people? The undercurrent in all of this is the sense that efforts to curb discrimination against people of color, while admirable in the past, have gotten out of control and are somehow now hurting whites. And you'll hear this kind of thing all the time. People complaining about what they call reverse discrimination.
This is a case of clear and obvious reverse discrimination.
Complaining about affirmative action.
What do you think that affirmative action is for?
Affirmative action is to increase diversity by discriminating against white males, and that's why I oppose it.
Or they say that since we have scholarships for black students, we should have scholarships for white students only as well.
Dozens, hundreds, thousands of ethnically based scholarships
that were for this group, that group, or whichever, mm-hmm. but none of them were focusing on Caucasian Americans.
The implication is that if we're being fair, we should also talk about how white people are sometimes the victims of racism. In fact, when researchers from Tufts and Harvard universities recently asked white people if racism against whites was worse than racism against people of color, most of them said yes, that the gains of people of color were coming at a direct cost to whites.
I'm really not proud of this statement that I'm about to make, but if I look at an application and I see we're an equal opportunity employer, like, that's great, A-plus job. But in the back of my mind, I'm kind of like, crap, I hope they don't have, like, this kind of quota thing, like you guys were saying, where they need to fill up a certain amount of different races. I feel weird saying anything about this just because it's just like, oh, this is what it's like, so.
And while there's no question, there's real anxiety and fear when it comes to programs like affirmative action. The fact is, for every person of color who benefits from affirmative action in college, there are two white students who received preferential treatment because of their parents' alumni status or other family connections.
If, in fact, the concern over so-called reverse discrimination had any relationship to reality, people of color would, in fact, be getting all the good stuff. Some people think they are. I hear it all the time. People of color are taking all the good jobs. Where the hell are these jobs? In Second Life?
Another study found that only about 0.25% of all the scholarship money in this country is specifically earmarked for students of color, which means 99.75% of all that scholarship money is money that whites can compete for, and the vast majority of those dollars will in fact go to white students. There's also the fact that the schools attended by mostly black and Latino students are more than 10 times as likely as majority white schools to be places of concentrated poverty.
By the time anyone steps on a college campus, there has already been 12 to 13 years of institutionalized affirmative action for white folks, that is to say, racially embedded inequality, which has benefited those of us who are white.
But even though that's true, there's clearly this feeling among a lot of white people that things used to be easier, and that now those good old days are slipping away.
How did we get here? I don't even understand this America anymore.
And underneath all of that is a very clear, if unstated, racial subtext.
And now to talk about what matters, and we're going to continue our conversation about all the vitriol going on in the country. I spoke with anti-racist activist Tim Wise about the tone of the Tea Parties being held.
In 2009, I was asked to appear several times on CNN to talk about the Tea Party, a group of conservative Americans who have been holding rallies around the country clamoring for the U.S. to return to a time of low taxes and small government.
Basically, restoring conservative values to the country.
Too much government, but the government is never bigger than the people.
Smaller government, lower taxes, and individual freedom.
The author of Between Barack and a Hard Place, his name is Tim Wise, he told me there are some racist undertones to these rallies.
Well, like I said on the show before, it is the background noise of a lot of the opposition. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
My point on the show was that while the Tea Party movement purported to be about things like big government, exploding debt and deficits, liberal elites being out of touch with the common man, in reality, there was something else going on.
We are losing our country. We think the Muslims are moving in and taking over.
They're taking our liberties away. It's tyranny. It's a Gestapo-type check.
I want you to check out this protester. See the sign he's waving there? It's the president made to look like an African witch doctor that was a popular prop at Saturday's rally.
Along with anxiety and fear about the economic crisis, there's also been a lot of unease about the fact that we have a black president and that the demographics of the country are shifting in ways that point to a future where whites will no longer be the clear majority. All of this helps explain why some of these folks are so adamant, so angry, so upset that they, and I'm using their words now, want to take their country back.
We want our country back!
We want our
Tea Party message to Washington that we're going to take our country back.
We're just plain American people who are mad. We want to take our country back.
I have got to run here, but just real quickly, I was at a town hall yesterday, and I really had to take some people to task. Very nice people, but they were using those buzzwords that I don't think people realize all the time, like real Americans or give me back my America was one of the songs, or take back America. It's like, where has What do you mean by that?
Well, when you stand up and you wax nostalgic and say things like, I want the country that the founders envisioned, when the country the founders envisioned was a formal system of white supremacy, excuse me if I find it a little hard to think that race is not perhaps playing a pretty big role.
After one of the CNN appearances, I got an email from a woman who was a Tea Party supporter, who was upset with my characterization of the Tea Party movement. She said that their calls to take the country back had nothing to do with race, that they were simply calling for a return to an era of low taxes and small government. When I replied to her, I asked her to give me a year that epitomized, in her mind, this era of American history. Which year did she and the rest of the Tea Party want to return to? Her response was almost immediate and not very surprising. The year she chose? 1957.
Leave it to Beaver.
It's a year that many conservative white Americans hold dear, and not just because it's the year Leave It to Beaver premiered on television.
Traditional America as we knew it is gone. Ward,
well,
Wally, and the Beave, out of here.
For many conservatives, that was the golden age of American history, a time when everything was in its place before all the struggles for equality and justice came along in the 60s and messed everything up.
Do you remember how that felt? Do you remember what life was like?
There's this sense that we've lost something precious, special, deeply American.
This is about the systematic dismantling of this country.
We are truly concerned about the heartbeat of our country.
They can have my country when they pry it from my cold, dead hands.
That people are overtaxed, overburdened, forced to hand over their hard-earned money to government bureaucrats so they can reward people for not working.
I think the fact is, Americans are overtaxed.
Government is spending too much, that we pay too high a tax.
I mean, everyone in America knows that Americans are overtaxed. Hello. We pay more taxes than we used to pay at every level.
The only problem with that argument, it's not even close to being true. The fact is, the top marginal tax rate in 2012 was 35%. A lot of people today think that rate is too high. But what was the rate in 1957? It was a whopping 91%. Nearly three times higher than what it is today.
There's too much involved in the government. We can take care of ourselves.
Our government is spending far too much, and our federal government is far too large, trying to do far too much.
As for the size of government, in the pre-civil rights golden age, it wasn't small by any stretch of the imagination. The programs created by the New Deal, which disproportionately and almost exclusively benefited white people, weren't just massive in scale, they were massively popular. So why do we have this idea that the pre-1960s was this bastion of American independence and freedom, of small government and low taxes? And why do so many people today want to go back to that mythologized past? According to Martin Gillens, it has everything to do with our perception of who we think is benefiting from government programs today, especially those programs we like to call welfare.
I'm Marty Gillens. I'm a political science professor at Princeton University. And much of my research is on public attitudes towards anti-poverty policy and racial policy. The major work that I've done in that area is a book called Why Americans Hate Welfare.
Welfare spending now topping $1 trillion a year.
The American public tends to view welfare recipients as undeserving, not really working hard to support themselves, and view welfare recipients as disproportionately black. Both of those perceptions are at variance with what we know about the reality of welfare recipients.
Even though the clear majority of people who benefit from government assistance are white, there's this perception that welfare and other government programs are somehow a black phenomenon. Why is this? Well, Gillen says it's because that's who we see on TV.
Starting in 1965, media portrayals of the poor have been disproportionately African-American.
Esther Williams, 21 years old, mother of a 19-month-old infant and a welfare client.
If you look at either print news or television news coverage of poverty, you see far too many black faces relative to the true proportions of African-Americans among the poor in this country.
Alcinette Vargas, who has six children and a husband with a minimum wage job, reached her time limit in January without full-time work and was cut from welfare.
So when we see stories about the poor are represented by people of color at a rate that is far greater than statistical reality. But it wasn't always that way. Before the mid-60s, media coverage of the poor consisted mostly of whites. It was the unemployed during the Depression, the people who fled the Dust Bowl, the rural poor in places like Appalachia. And the coverage of these poor white folks was overwhelmingly sympathetic and humanizing. As a result, public support for social safety net programs was high from the period of the Great Depression all the way into the 1960s. But all of that changed.
There are too many people taking advantage of the system. Why don't we spend some time developing a system that weeds out the cheaters?
Once news coverage, media imagery, and political rhetoric started to equate poverty with people of color, we began to view the poor not as fellow Americans who were the hard luck victims of a system that had failed them, but instead as moochers who were abusing the system and undermining the nation's work ethic. And the sad irony is that there are millions of white people in this country who need those programs too, and now they're not there. Those programs have been cut to the bone because the beneficiaries have been seen as undesirable, undeserving others.
How long will we have to pay for slavery? Man, I'm talking about the people on welfare trying to suck out the economy of this country, get a free house, a free car, free gasoline. They want it all because they think they deserve it. Well, in this country, you got to get a job. So, you know, and work.
Did you get a tax cut this year from Barack Obama?
I don't pay taxes.
I'm
disabled from a truck accident and veterans benefits.
May I speak now?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm 90 years old, and I just wanted to ask the colored man, why don't colored people, instead of saying what we did to them, why don't they say what we did for them? They talk about the slavery, but since then they have given welfare, free medicine, free everything.
Ma'am, I think this is more of a conversation about the relationship between the administration and the people on Wall Street, and not necessarily one that's based on race.
Oh, okay, I'm not a racist. That was my comment. Thank you.
None of this is by accident. The racial subtext that runs through a lot of the anti-government rhetoric is the result of an explicit political strategy that's been put to use by conservative politicians for decades.
Here's how I would approach that issue as a statistician or a political scientist, or no, as a psychologist, which I'm not, is how abstract you handle the race.
In a recently uncovered recording, the late Republican strategist Lee Atwater, one of the pioneers of race-based political appeals, was heard talking quite openly about how the strategy works.
You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger, that hurts your fat fire, so you say stuff like force plus and states' rights and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now. You're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than white.
The idea was for Republican politicians to speak in a kind of racial code designed to turn white working class voters against government programs, the very programs that they themselves had benefited from for years.
The present welfare system has become a monstrous, consuming outrage.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And this kind of thing runs right up to the present day.
President Obama is the most effective food stamp president in American history.
This is precisely the point historian John Bracey, a veteran of the civil rights movement, has been trying to make for years.
What the ruling class in this country has successfully done is to label social programs as black programs, minority programs, and then you can kill it.
I don't want to make black people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money.
You know, that's the most foundational thing in American life. I mean, that's Obamacare.
Everything that is getting pushed through Congress, including this health care bill, are transforming America. And they are all driven by President Obama's thinking on one idea, reparations.
Virtually every normal kind of social program that would have kicked in Europe in the 19th century, you know, in order to help working people, you know, survive under capitalism, we don't have.
While the state's budget deficit has reached almost $500 million now, the state's Medicare program has announced more than $14 million is being cut to various providers throughout the state.
There are people that want to expand Medicare. Like I just got back from Mississippi. They're debating expanding Medicare in Mississippi. They need every nickel and dime they can get in there from anybody. They should not question anybody. If Martians came and said, we're going to give you something, they should say, whatever it is, we'll take it, because they need everything. They refuse. They have a political system that's still dysfunctional enough that they turn down aid for white people in Mississippi, because black people get some too.
This is how racism victimizes white people indirectly as well. American history is full of examples of white anxiety and resentment around race being used to undermine their own interest and their own well-being.
The most obvious kind of cost of failing to deal with black people as human beings is the almost 1 million casualties of white people during the Civil War itself. By postponing the struggle, you know, to end slavery, by not dealing with it in a political fashion, he had to fight a war that lasted 4 years. That war resulted in the largest number of casualties in any war in American history. This is a war, an internal war, a war on this continent fought between white people on one side and white people on the other side. If you had asked them, you know, would they be willing to give their lives to free black people, they probably wouldn't have said yes. Right? But by failing to see black people as people, by failing to see slavery as a detriment to the social order, they resulted, you know, it resulted in them losing their lives.
You can never whip these birds if you don't keep you and them separate. I found that out in 11 years. You've got to keep the white and the black separate.
In other words, for generations, political elites have deliberately manipulated the white racial fears and resentments of the majority population, pitting white folks and people of color against each other for the spoils of a system that really none of them benefit directly from, fighting over the pieces of a pie that none of them own. We can try to ignore and deny this history, but we can't change it. It's real, and it's a part of who we are. The biggest challenge is figuring out how to confront the truth without being overwhelmed by it.
I think we talk about race too much. I think those problems are largely behind us. I just think we talk so much about it that we helped, I think, create somewhat of an illusion.
Many of us have come to believe that the real problem with racism is that we talk about it too much.
We need to talk about race. We need to stop talking about race.
That if we just didn't talk about it, if we just didn't bring it up, nobody would know anything about it.
I think more of the problem is the accusations of racism, and that does drive the races apart.
I think that we should be colorblind in every way.
That we should aspire to be colorblind. That we should ignore racial and ethnic differences and just treat everyone the same.
We really want to get beyond the hyphenated America. I mean, I do. I mean, I'm half Polish and then I'm like Irish, English. We want to get beyond that.
Unfortunately, there are a couple of big problems with that approach.
Well, one, it's absurd, right? We obviously notice race all the time. If we didn't, we wouldn't have evidence that people treat people in unequal ways on the basis of race. But on top of that, colorblindness as an ideology is almost a willful neglect. I'm going to close my eyes to the reality both of diversity and the reality of inequality and injustice.
Because America is about opportunity and chance, an equal shot.
Fundamentally, everybody is equal in America. Everyone has equal opportunity.
There's also the fact that if we don't have a context for understanding the kinds of racial disparities and inequalities we continue to see in America, then racist explanations begin to make sense. If the one story from American history that we've bought into is that we're a meritocracy, a colorblind society that rewards people or punishes them based purely on how hard they work or how capable they are, then the entire history of institutional racism magically disappears, and we're left to wonder, what's wrong with black people who can't seem to get it together?
Half of African Americans in the state of California, roughly half of Latino families, have no access to a checking account or an ATM. Things we take for granted. They don't have a checking
account. What's wrong with that?
We can talk about
flawed?
No, they're hardly flawed, but they're struggling.
Genetics are making their work. Why so many of them?
In other words, colorblindness, by virtue of keeping matters of discrimination and racism under wraps, can lead to an actual intensification of racist thinking. So let me give you an example. In April 2003, on my way to a conference in Iowa, I boarded a plane bound for St. Louis. As I walked down the jet bridge that morning, I glanced in and saw something I'd never seen in all my years of air travel. Not one, but two black pilots at the controls of the plane. Now you'd think this would be a welcome sight to me. And after reflection, it was, but that wasn't my initial reaction. Sadly, my first thought was more along the lines of,
"All right now, everybody, get in crash position."
Oh God, can these two guys really fly this plane? Now, don't get me wrong, just as quickly as that thought came into my head, I was able to defeat it. I knew instantly that such a thought was absurd. But in that moment, I was beholden to my conditioning. And I'd been conditioned no less than anyone else to see people of color and automatically assume they aren't as qualified as a white person. Neuroscientists and psychologists have been studying this phenomenon for decades. They call it implicit or unconscious racial bias.
Implicit racial bias is the thoughts that pop into our mind. It's the quick, random gut reaction when we think about a particular group. So when I see somebody who is white, how quickly and easily do good thoughts, good, healthy, successful, educated, smart, come to mind? And versus when I see someone who's black or Latino, how quickly do those kinds of happy, successful, educated, smart pop into mind? And we typically find that people are faster at associating those good stuff with white rather than black or Hispanics. The reason why these implicit attitudes, preferences, and biases make a big difference is that there's quite a bit of data showing that these implicit attitudes affect people's behavior in a whole host of areas that will either maintain or sometimes exacerbate inequalities.
In one test that looked at unconscious stereotyping, the vast majority of whites implicitly associated the faces of black Americans with negative words and traits like evil character or failure. And they had far more trouble linking black faces to pleasant words and positive features.
A rough estimate is that 75% of people who are non-black tend to show some degree of implicit preference for whites over blacks.
In the same test, nearly half the African Americans tested also showed a preference for whites over blacks. So none of us are immune. We're all subject to the same conditioning.
One of the things that's so interesting to me about the unconscious bias research is that this is not simply, you know, white people having biases against black people and Latinos. This operates across groups. This is a culture that we have learned that practices inequality. This is not simply animus between groups, but this is a way that we are socialized to treat people.
The logical question is, what can we do?
You can't be colorblind because that means that you're not seeing the disparity and you're not trying to address it. We all have to see it, address it, make it real, and try to resolve it, as opposed to pretend it's not there. It's there.
The goal, in my view, isn't to be blind to one another, but to see each other as we are, with our full range of experience, all of our baggage, as well as all the beauty that we bring, and still love one another, still care about each other. I don't want to say to the young kid who grew up in the hood and who's being stopped and hounded by the police, "I don't care if you're black." Of course I care. I care about you and your experience, and I see you as you are.
The answer is being color conscious, not colorblind. It means confronting the truth about race and racism in this country, and it means asking the tough, honest questions about how the history of racism in America continues to shape the present.
When you're a member of a dominant group, it's very easy, isn't it, to view the world that way, to view the world as an individual, to not recognize that other people are not leading simply individual lives, and neither are you. That's why people will say things like, "Well, I'm not white, I'm just Tim." "I'm just an individual. I'm just an American. Why can't we just all be? Why can't you drop the hyphen?" Because it's not your hyphen to drop, Jack. That's why.
In other words, we need to have an awareness about how racism, racial conditioning, and prejudice have affected us as white folks. Unless we get a hold of that, we'll continue to go down the path of privilege and racism and inequality rather than connecting to a very different tradition in our own history, a tradition of white allyship, a tradition of white anti-racism. In addition to the typically pathetic way our history books address the contributions of people of color, very rarely is much attention paid to the average, everyday white folks who stood up and opposed injustice. People like Will Campbell.
FF's units are already on duty on the grounds of Central High School.
Colored people here in the South have got better schools than some of the white kids. Like it is, let them go to their own school.
Imagine how different the racial dialogue might feel for us if we knew of those white folks who opposed enslavement, who opposed segregation. Jeremiah Evarts, John Fee, Helen Hunt Jackson, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, Robert Flannoy, Matilda Gage, Lydia Child. How helpful might it be for lessening our anxiety as whites and allowing us to embrace the multiracial future of America if we knew about the history of white anti-racism? Alternative tradition in our history, the one in which members of our community said no to racism and white domination and yes to justice, precisely because they realized not only the moral evil of those systems, but also because they saw both of them as cynical manipulations intended to divide and conquer working people, to keep us at each other's throats. People like Ann Braden.
The real danger today comes from the people in high places who are telling the white people that if their taxes are eaten up, their
Virginia Foster Durr, Jay Watisse Waring, Constance Curry, Bob and Dottie Zellner, and Mab Segrist, along with literally thousands of others who in their own way have demonstrated that there is more than one way to live in this skin. It's a tradition that fits with the best of the American ideal and can elevate that ideal to a place far more concrete than it's been up to now. And if we do that, there's no reason why we as a committed and decent people can't move to a different place as a country.
So that, I feel, gives a nice summary overview of what we've been talking about the past 5 weeks. On Tuesday, we're going to focus on the last chapter in the section on Native Americans and multiracial people. I have a review guide for the first exam that you guys can take, and it's basically just, it's going to be the concepts I'm going to cover on the exam, so make sure you know how to define or explain each of those concepts and provide real-world examples of how they played out.